It was only one of the necessary means to an end. So I quote bits here and there from the record merely to give a picture of the sort of thing that went on. Condensed version used in Across the Unknown. 134, The Road I Know. 135, I see, said Betty, in running comment. Now, just to slip off my body leave it lying on the floor so much easier to work from this end back. I'm getting so much more at home here. An interval followed, with no comment. Now they've brought me back to contemplate my body. They think I can improve my control. Again the pause. They're just letting me into my body and out again, just a flash, to get control of doing it. It's wonderful practice in a kind of balance, in keeping my spirit so balanced that it gets no drag from the body. I've got to keep quiet to do this, or I'll never get anywhere. This is fine. So much more strength this way. See how much quieter I am lying. Practice in leaving the body, said the invisibles to me by way of explanation. Then in command to Betty, enter the body. Now release. I've got to keep leaving and entering, alternating, said Betty. Short silence. My head and neck are tired in my body, she complained presently. I'd like to turn. I'm going to try. So painful to think about my body. She tried to move, but failed. Shall I move your head for you? I asked. Toward the wall, said Betty. I obeyed. 136, that's better. The road I know. There ensued a long silence, but obviously a busy silence. I can't hold it anymore, said she at last. I fell over. I oughtn't to have done that. Now I can rest, they say. Here ensued another long silence, but this time obviously not busy. See, try once more, the invisibles told her at last. Another pause. Yes, I can do it, said Betty. Now wait until I alternate again. I did it. That's very, very useful. The lesson continued thus for upward of an hour. Then Betty was free to tell me a little something about it, while still in her trance state. You withdrew all attention from your body, which is very difficult, she told me. I thought of it as so heavy as to be impossible to move, while I, the living, left it in the coma and walked off in my spiritual body. That worked until my hay fever wanted to make me sneeze. The main thing is that, during the day, about your affairs, you can at odd moments, practice retiring to that spiritual body. Withdraw attention from the other, until you get helpful control. It is very important for me to learn it. I'm going to come out pretty soon. I'm just hanging around. The road I know. 137. It is a matter of withdrawing attention from one thing, and giving it full strength to another. It must be done before I can go on. They can't keep on dragging my body around. I've got to get control so I can leave that entirely behind. They say the reason I always come back so soon is that I'm a self-stopper. I've got to stop wobbling and prepare to go all the way and not want to snap back. It is like standing on my head. It's that oh dear, I'm going to wobble and come down idea that brings me back. The more you can relax the body all the time, said the invisibles, the more power you possess and the more you can use the spiritual in contact with the physical. Ignore the body, except for its necessary functions. The first point is to keep it in health, so that it can be the more easily ignored. Now I am going to do it over again, said Betty. This must be made more trustworthy. Such a strange light. For some little time she was silent. I can travel a little now, she resumed. Getting the idea of unattached motion. I've been so tethered before. But it is hard for me to see, it's so dim. One of the most powerful forces is belief in your power to do it, said the invisibles. That combined with effort to make good in it, will accomplish almost anything. Without that you sink into your own limitations and consider them impossible to overcome. But, 138, the road I know. If you get the belief that it can be done and back it up, presto. It is done, and you have opened new doors. It is the halfness of trying doggedly without the belief that gets you nowhere. I've always wanted to explain that holding steady process that gets you here, but I've never been able to, said Betty. I think I'd call it a condensation of purpose, But condensation is not quite it, because it depends so much on expansion and breadth of perception. 2. With practice, getting out of the body, like the other things, became for Betty less and less a question of concentration and struggle. One day, after several months of off and on practice, she suddenly seemed to understand the knack. "Why?" she cried, somewhat astonished. "I can slip back and forth easily today. It is very strange. The wind swept through me as I came in. I hailed it, did not crouch before it, and it went through me as sun goes through you. I wasn't conscious of my body anymore, I was just conscious of vigorous well-being, almost as disembodied as one could hope to be. Harmonious vitality superseded the mortal sensation." She paused in her reporting, apparently trying out her newfound skill. "The road I know, 139. I like slipping back and forth that way," she confided presently. "I don't see why it isn't just as interesting a performance, and vastly more desirable, as learning to swim in an element that is not your own. It is just as natural, really. I just leap out of myself, and take a dive into a freer and more stimulating element. Each time I do it, it gets easier. I am more at home in it, and more stimulated by it. I am not tremendously good at it. But it's just as simple as that." 3. From then on, Betty had little or no trouble with the getting out part, but the return to the body without undesirable repercussion, so to speak, was another matter. "The danger of this experience is always in coming back," she explained to me, "in arousing the body, like an invalid who thinks she's been abused. That's the attitude with which you must look at your bodily weaknesses always. You must be their trained nurse, giving them only such attention as is wholesome and such care as is necessary and such sympathy as is good for them." She broke off to consider this, and, she continued, "there's no use saying, 'I'll do it next time.' Not next time, this time. This is the only time there is, comma, you must say that to yourself. 140. The road I know, you are not rising above the body, after the usual method, you're non-existing it, humorously, ridiculing it out of its habits. But, after all, one's so likely to be more in the frame of mind of the family relative than of the trained nurse." "Listen," said the invisibles. "There is a kind of invalid's room in which your body has established its habits and weaknesses. You are coming back now, but you are not going to let your active, vigorous, pulsing, living being more than visit and cheer that room." "Well," said Betty, "I'll just stay quiet and pack up my ideas. I must come away. I'm getting drowsy, and I am a little afraid of that state in between, but I have to pass through it each time. I'm coming back." A pause. "I'm almost back. It seems like a fairy world now." Chapter 12. Rest on Attainment 1. All of Betty's instructions, and all of the work she was called upon to do, conformed to the law of rhythm. That is to say, she had alternate periods of activity and of rest. But the usual notion of rest as semi-comatose loafing was promptly knocked from under us. After a prolonged period of what she termed striving, Betty considered herself entitled to what she called a sagback party. "The way you sagback when boresome callers go at last," she explained. And at once she made an astounding discovery. "Why? That's funny. It certainly is. I hunted and hunted, and there is not any place in the whole universe where you can slump!" Exclamation mark. I fell behind looking for it. Now somebody's helping me catch up just to see what it feels like, the difference. No place to slump. Not even when you catch up. It is less strain to keep your place. It's a more comfortable feeling. There's no standing still, you can stand still, if you want to, she decided after further investigation, but you can't sit down. 141, 142, the road I know. This paradox puzzled her. She retired into another of those inner experiences of hers which I always hoped was going to mean something or other to me, in time. "They straightened me out in fine shape," she confided presently. "I had lost my equilibrium and sat down. It's a funny thing, but you can't do that. You've got to keep going when you once start. It's as if you were to decide that your heart had beat long enough, and you thought you'd stop it a while. It was only later, and after several sessions of gropings, that she again reported anything to me. After every great spiritual effort, I've always been left with a slightly vacuum-like spent feeling, said she. As if I put in my all and was entitled to a vacation, a slight reaction, a slump, getting back to a comfortable and ordinary level. That's the way I've been doing, the way everybody does. Well now, there's another kind of relaxation, another kind of rest. Instead of going back each time to your own starting place, which is merely an unnecessary habit, discard that idea, and enjoy resting on the she stumbled for a word or phrase. Rest on attainment, supplied the invisibles, cryptically. Here was a new concept for Betty to absorb and to clarify. The road I know too. 143. The only relaxation is in accustomedness, the invisibles tried to explain. When you get accustomed to a thing, it does not tire you, you can rest in your attainment. You may just as well give up right now any idea of slumping, because you never can, unless you back out. All you can do is to work so hard you get used to it, so that it doesn't tire you. There's great joy in it, though, when you get there. It did not sound very restful to me. I said so. They say I mustn't think of being racked and spent and tired, said Betty. I must rest in what I have attained. That is the real refreshment. It doesn't tire you so much when you start expanding if you rest on what you've attained. That's quite nice. It transfers your center of consciousness. Such a new way of resting. With an air of discovery, she announced that this dash, but you missed the point, Joan writes me, in comment on this part of the miss, of course you rest on attainment. Take a mere physical dexterity, like learning to knit, which I did not do until about 5 years ago. My fingers were stiff and clumsy, I lost stitches off my needle, it was very hard for this old dog to teach new tricks. I was about to give up in despair. Then suddenly I could knit. Now when I am weary, I rest myself by knitting. Work one knows how to do is never wearying when pursued normally. We rest on that attainment, and only tire over some new process of learning. Transfer this fact from the physical into Betty's spiritual, and you'll understand. I think Joan is right. 144. The road I know, feeling tired business is largely a matter of what the body seems to expect of us. I am apartment to think I am tired when I come back, said she, but it's only a peevish kind of resentment of my body. I'll just ignore that. I'm not tired, I'm just used comma like a slate. I can brush it off and fix it. I must never, she continued, admit a weak or tired thought at that stage. If I do, it dilutes the impression, like leaving something unstoppered. It runs out. Stay up on your hilltop, make yourself at home there, advise the invisibles. No sense in you, the real you, coming back. Rest up there and have a new starting point. This going back every time is just poor technique. You can do it, but it's clumsy and laborious. It's nice to stay up, admitted Betty, after she had considered this, but it's new nice. I still want to go back and slump, that's old nice. Well, I'll try it, it's a stronger kind of rest, she reported to me. Sort of leaving your consciousness on the top shelf instead of bringing it back to rest on unpadded nerves. She was silent so long that I asked her what she was doing. I'm tidying up to come back, said she. The road I know 3. 145. Now listen, said the invisibles, there's no restless feeling of perpetual motion about it. It's more a feeling of warm existence, like quiet and very active rays. It's like the sun growing things, that kind of life. It keeps you living outside, in advance of yourself, instead of occupied with your physical self. I'll try it, agreed Betty. I won't allow myself to think when I'm tired. When I'm tired, I'll be in a derrick and lift automatically without thinking. It will probably work, if you say so. She sounded doubtful. I see, it will be outside of myself. It'll take some doing. She chuckled. Mere derrick. Make it mechanical. I see, instead of damaging my real substance by drawing on it. All right, come on, we'll go try it. Don't spend yourself on what your mechanism can do, supplemented the invisibles. I know lots of things, but I can't teach myself them, observed Betty quaintly. I want to go now with myself that knows lots of things. It's nice not to try to understand, just to know. Ensued a long pause. I did not come all the way back, she cried triumphantly. I distinctly did not come all the way back today. I may not be able to stay there, the main thing is not to slump back automatically. You can be at ease without being out of formation, said the Invisibles. 146, the road I know, what was that expression? Queried Betty. Rest in attainment. At first I thought that a terrible idea, but there is rest to it. Only, I don't get it unless I've attained. It's the rest you find in being, unconscious of your struggle because you are strong enough for it. Apparently she eventually surrounded the technique to her own and the Invisible's satisfaction. Years later she had this to say, it used to be such an effort to keep going. Now it's such a discomfort to stop. My being seems to consist entirely of the feeling of machine in action. I'm set in action, wound up, my machinery is going. It's the feeling of the next stratum of energy above us which they talked about. There is indeed, said she, a rhythm of rest and accomplishment. It is the rest of incoming and outgoing. I wish I could find a name for it all. There is a poise, well-being about this thing. It is a vigorous rest. I'm enthusiastic and vigorous, yet I'm resting, without slumping. How would I say that? Rest isn't the word, it's a pause of consciousness. It's a kind of radiation, which is a sort of worship. There ought to be some name for that pause in application that sort of shoots out. It ought to be done lots, to fill up the gaps, to heal. Lots of it is needed everywhere, all through life, it's a kind of ventilation. I'll just do it a while and see if some word comes up to claim it, but no word did. Chapter 13 The Near Country. When Betty first set out on the road, it seemed to her, and hence to me, that she journeyed far to touch even the first contact with these new and strange forces. And when she came actually to that phase in which she left the body in order to explore or to follow wheresoever in the other consciousness she was led, the impression of distance was deepened. She so expressed her experience, I'm going away off now. My. I'm going deep. Still farther? I'm being taken away now. Always the impression of travel to some remote destination. And when she faced back the return trip seemed to her as long. This impression, astoundingly, proved to be an illusion. It arose, I think, partly from Betty's own sense of radical change of environment, which in our world ordinarily means distance, and partly from mankind's age-long mental habit of considering heaven up and hell down, and the heavenly messengers descending to us on ladders or beams of light. After Betty had gone to her unobstructed universe, she showed an amusing impatience over this idea. She was talking, through Joan, to a young woman she had known well in our life. Something was said that indicated confusion in the 147, 148, the road I know, latter's mind. Betty stopped the discussion with the abrupt question, what is your idea of where I am now, anyway? Why, replied the young woman, rather vaguely, why, I just think of you as suspended somehow, in space. I am right here, stated Betty vigorously. There is only one universe. There is no separate heaven. My world is your world plus. Even while here, she grew to understand that the two phrases, leaving the body and going far, were only a manner of speaking, and that she could modify them to advantage. Leaving the body became more a matter of withdrawing, completely, attention from the body. And the journey simply did not exist. It makes the world seem so small, she commented, when you reach out for people, and the space between somehow shuts up like a telescope. I don't understand that. Got to do some experimenting around. I don't see how you can pull out and push in space like that. The following long experimenting around pause was obviously occupied in the why, how astonishingly near that brings things. She burst out. Isn't that astonishing? Why, isn't that astonishing? Even the distance to the other consciousness is not a distance of space, it's a slowness or torpidity dash. I quoted this incident in the unobstructed universe, but it is worth repetition here. The road I know, 149, in penetrating. It's just lack of the right combination that makes it seem distant. It is so near when you clear that intervening denseness which is not space. How can I tell this? Supposing I was in a dark room, and then a bright light was turned on. The darkness and the light occupy the same area, don't they? One overcomes the other and reveals what the other did not. Well, instead of being in the dark substance of consciousness, I'm in the brighter revealing one. Density is gone. I'm in the same place I was, but with greater vision. It is all one, here, now. All the heavens and bells and universes superimposed. Why, that is perfectly tremendous. It gets nearer and nearer until it all seems right on top of me. More and more revealing light. I can't pierce it further. I'm not big enough. It would overwhelm me and burst me. I can't do it. This was enormously interesting to me at the time. It is more so today, for now it appears as the first inkling of the brilliant exposition of space and time Betty was to give us, 15 years later through Joan, in her book, The Unobstructed Universe. In the immediately subsequent sessions the concept was further developed. I see. She began, after a long interval of silent investigation, space is only an imaginary boundary, not a definite reality. How curious it looks. There isn't, 150, the road I know, any such thing as that word pattern we call space. It's altogether different. She paused to examine further. This is too much for me. She resumed. My goodness. There's no use trying to figure it out while you're living. You couldn't hold on to the idea when you brought it back. I don't believe I could stand an idea like that and get back and live again sensibly. But I'll try to tell you. I'm gasping over it, and I'll spoil it, but I'll try. Yesterday when I looked at a pebble under the microscope, I looked down into a deep canyon of space. I can walk on that pebble, and yet, by the magic of concentration, a tiny crevice in it can be refracted to the illusion of a real canyon with true immensity. How can you measure space? How can you give anything so elastic and changing the name of space? Don't you see, space is not real at all. It is contained in an attribute of your consciousness. Consider, suggested the invisibles, the magnitude of your own illusion of space as compared with the space of an unrefracted pebble. Now raise it again to an incomprehensible magnitude such as you can only guess at. Betty thought this over a while. Then, in a puzzled tone, we are all apparently occupying the same space. It doesn't seem to be a case of distance at all. This, the road I know, 151, is quite new to me and very satisfactory, because I never could see how they'd have room for everything and everybody who'd ever died. This is much better, only I can't understand it clearly. Well, anyhow, I'm never going to have any respect for space again, because I know now it's altogether too unreliable. It depends utterly on who is looking at it. I'm sorry I did not get that intelligently, but anyway it was a grand muckraking and exposure of space. You see, it's a word that hasn't any standing at all, except with us. It represents only what we think about it. But I must say it's rather exhausting to struggle with, since I don't seem to have much influence with it, and yet have work to do in it. Space is not distance, concluded the invisibles. Space is degrees of perception. Distance is only slowness in getting there. How can one speak of life beyond, cried Betty, when there is here. Chapter 14 Gates Beyond Gates 1. That concept, the hairiness rather than the threeness, has at least the merit of relieving my own mind. I had never quite liked the idea that Betty was being taught to leave her body and go sky-hooting off into unknown and distant spaces. But if leaving the body meant, as it now seemed, merely a complete withdrawal of attention from the body, and a transfer of being into a different center of the same consciousness, why then that wasn't so bad. Nevertheless, the new field was remote in that, without such training as Betty was receiving, we enter it consciously only through the portals of death. In that sense, at least, she was exploring a distant world. Exploration of this new region was not merely to satisfy curiosity. It had a definite purpose, concerned as it was with universals. I'm always afraid of being monkey-minded over here, she told me. There's so much to see and do. Though the invisibles described the purpose as expansion of consciousness, that appeared to have a number of facets. She was to learn wisdom by precept and actual experience, She was to establish headquarters 152, the road I know, 153, in the higher consciousness from which to direct her daily life. She was even to develop certain supernormal powers which are generally lumped under the term occult. This last was an alluring sideline. It had the fascination of taking rabbits out of hats. Doubtless that is why it is made the end and aim of many so-called systems of development. The average of us, whether we believe or wholly scoff, like to bear about adepts and masters and white and black magicians and witch doctors and voodoo, but only as they are able to perform mystifying stunts. Well, in due time Betty learned to perform stunts, when they were useful to the main objective, but only then. That was the point. Either she or the invisibles, I forget which, once stated the criterion for that sort of thing. When a means is made an end in itself, it at once becomes a deterrent. In other words, conscious attempts to develop psychic powers for their own sakes are putting the cart before the horse, and are quite likely dangerous in the long run. The safe road is to seek higher consciousness, and then such psychic powers as are useful to that end accompany, or follow as a byproduct. Betty did acquire psychic powers. But she was never much interested in them, except as faculties to be utilized in the world of higher consciousness as we utilize our faculties of sight and hearing in our own world. 154, the road I know, nevertheless, as they were her faculties and for her use, enough legitimate occasion in ordinary life happened by to furnish material for many chapters of the Believe It or Not variety, with a telling of such our program. For instance, as we have seen, she had been taught very definitely how to leave her body, in the occult sense. But that ability was for the purpose of her explorations, and she confined her use of it to just that purpose, except on a few rare and obviously legitimate occasions. As when she reached across the continent, 3,000 miles, to the sick room of a relative. She reported to me how he was, she described the room, who was in that room, and what they were doing. Details confirmed to the last item by letter. She also learned to partake of another's mind, which is perhaps more accurate than saying she could read another's thoughts, and, again on very rare occasions, did so, but ordinarily her scruples would not permit. It would be an invasion of privacy, said she. Doing psychic work in the usual sense for others was no part of her job, and this aspect, too, she declined. However, because the circumstances made it seem to her almost obligatory, she solved a mystery as to whether murder or suicide, so convincingly that not only did the widow receive a large sum of insurance, but a rascally business associate was glad to disgorge. The road I know, 155, over the period of years such things happened, not often, but when they did they were of practical value. 2. For most of us, I think, such unique possibilities would have held something of allure. But Betty was not much tempted. Her interest was too completely centered in the exploration of her new world. And this, even I could see, was a man-sized job. Betty's attempts to describe that world were a constant struggle. This new region, it seemed, was so utterly novel as to be next to inexpressible. But apparently the reporting back was an essential part of her program. Perhaps for crystallization in her own mind, perhaps for my benefit. I am trying hard to accustom myself, because I dimly feel I must acquire for you an actual knowledge of these fundamentals, she told me. They must be made living, vibrating intensifications of your consciousness, not just dead symbols of vaguely comprehended verities. I must accomplish it, first in my own exploratory fashion, then in its refinements and adaptations, its mental concepts and its verbal monuments. Naturally, she had a human desire to share her discoveries. I take such a childish delight in having a private, 156, the road I know, world, she confided. I'm so bursting with it sometimes that it seems as though people must know I have a big secret. I'll make a beautiful window so they can look and see what I see. This was ordinarily her attitude. But once in a while she balked a little at marring the clarity of her vision by any attempt at translation. Oh, but it would spoil it so to make a diagram of it. She protested. It's such a fragile thing. It's just begun. Please. Have I got to spoil it?